Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I am Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, and I'm your host for today's interview. And I'm very excited today to be joined by Dr. Todd Kerstetter. Dr. Kerstetter is a professor of history at Texas Christian University and is the author of Flood on the Tracks: Living, Dying, and the Nature of Disaster in the Elkhorn River Basin, which came out in 2018 with Texas Tech University Press as part of their Plains Histories series, and in 2019 actually won the Best Nonfiction Book Award from the Nebraska Center for the Book. Welcome to the New Books Network, Todd.
Thank you, Stephen. It's nice to be here, and thanks for having me.
To begin, why don't we just hear a little bit about you? What is your background, and especially, how did you become interested in history as a field of study and as a career?
Sure. I grew up outside of Cleveland, Ohio, right on the shores of Lake Erie, which I guess normally wouldn't be of much interest to people, except I think it plays into why we're here today and talking about this particular book. And I grew up there. I went to college at Duke in North Carolina, where I majored in political science and didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. When college ended, it was like I got the hang of it, and they kicked me out and said it was over. So I did a lot of different things, ranging from waiting tables, playing in a band, doing freelance journalism, and ended up doing newspaper reporting. And none of those things really worked out, and I really would get kind of out of sorts every May and June when I had to keep going to work all the time. And I realized that I missed the academic schedule and being free in the summers and having a lot more control over my life. And I chose political science as an undergraduate major because I thought that would help me with law school, and that, as you can tell, didn't pan out. And another element in that equation was that both my parents were teachers. So I grew up in a teaching household and very much accustomed to the academic calendar. And my dad was a high school history teacher. And all of that led to us taking some really wonderful summer vacations where we would load up the car and go places for 3-4 weeks at a time. And frequently stop at museums. I loved reading history books. Frequently at the museums, I'd pick up books about history of the places where we were visiting. And the trip that made the biggest impression on me was the summer of 1976. We drove from Cleveland west across the prairies, out across Iowa, Nebraska, into Colorado, and the landscape just floored me. It was so unlike anything that I'd seen in the East. The part of Ohio where I'm from looks a lot like New England. And to be out on the plains where there were no trees and just grass for as far as you could see, or corn for as far as you could see, really made an impression on me and reminded me of how when I was little, my parents had read to me from the Little House on the Prairie books and other Western adventures that really captured my attention. And then to be out on the landscape and see it and be humbled by it and try to imagine what it must have been like to be someone in the 1800s traveling west in a wagon train really grabbed me. And that continued as we went through the Rocky Mountains and saw places like Yellowstone and Yosemite. It just really fascinated me. But for practical reasons, or so I thought, as an undergraduate, I figured I'd be heading to law school or something you could make a living at other than history. But then after trying all those different jobs that I mentioned, I decided I'm gonna take a chance at doing what was really strongly in my heart, which was read history and study about history. So I applied to the University of Nebraska and thought I was going to go scratch that Western history itch, and did. Started graduate school in the fall of 1990 and worked with John Wunder in the history department there. And he got me into not only Western history, but introduced me to environmental history. And I was very fortunate by the time I got through to get a job here at TCU. And I've been here more or less ever since 1997. So it worked out delightfully. And I still think back to my first fall in graduate school after having all those jobs that were interesting, but not that satisfying, to show up in Lincoln and get paid to read books and go to school and study history just blew my mind. And I, for the most part, it still does blow my mind that I get paid to do this, although it's those days are fewer and farther between than they used to be. But that's the long story of how I got into history.
You know, I ask a similar question to all of my guests, and especially, and this is a podcast on the American West. Some books are more about the West than others that I cover on this show, but especially the ones that are really about the West by historians that identify as historians of the American West, they answer often something along those lines that, you know, I came from somewhere further east, and the first time I went to the West, the landscape and the environment and the place of the West really grabbed me and sucked me in. I mean, I know, just speaking for myself, I lived in Denver for a couple of years after spending my whole life on the East Coast, and that really set me on a similar trajectory. So yeah, what the story that you told is a real trend among we historians of the West.
And in another part I'll add in, I forgot to mention this, and it's a little embarrassing, especially the way things are right now in the profession, but I joke with my students a lot of times that when I make them read Frederick Jackson Turner, that I'm introducing them to the man who seduced me into becoming a historian, that once I got my hands on the significance of the frontier in American history, that just made such great sense to me. And I was so excited to go to graduate school and study more about that stuff. And the first semester I arrived, I find out that there's essentially a civil war among American West historians between Old West and Turnerian historians and the New West folks like Patty Limerick and Donald Worcester and so on. I've embraced that and found out how simplistic I was, but Turner really played a role in this as well.
Yeah. That's an interesting time to begin graduate school in the American West, is right in the throes of the new Western history battles. So let me ask you this. Why this particular book? Why write about, even you say yourself in the book, a pretty minor river on the Great Plains? That's not to lessen the importance of this river, but you call it just as much. So why write a book about the Elkhorn?
Right. Fly over river and fly over country.
Exactly.
So I've been interested in water my whole life. That's one of the reasons I mentioned that I grew up in Cleveland, and not necessarily in an academic way, but I've been very aware since I was a kid about water and water pollution. And where that comes from is one of my earliest memories is the Cuyahoga River catching on fire in 1969. And also, when I was a kid, I would go to day camp, and they would take us, or try to take us, to some of the beaches along Lake Erie so that we could swim. And there were a couple times in the summers, this was probably early 70s, where we either had the trip canceled or we got out to where the beach was, in the swimming beach, and it was closed because the water was so dirty they couldn't let us go in. So I've kind of always paid attention since then and been aware of water. And then when I got into graduate school and I was casting about for what I wanted to do, and I credit John Wunder, my advisor, for this, he recognized at the time, and again, this was early 90s, environmental history was still kind of coming into its own at that point. I'd never really heard about it or thought about it, And he thought it would be a good idea for me to study that and write my master's thesis on that, partly because of some general interest I had in the environment, and I think partly he foresaw that being maybe a nice marketing tool for me once I hit the market. That Western historians are, okay, you've got that market. If you can bring to the table some credentials in environmental history, that might make you a little bit more hireable when you hit the job market. So he suggested I do an environmental history for my master's thesis, and he helped me settle on doing the Elkhorn River for that project. So this book is really rooted in my master's thesis. And why the Elkhorn? Why a flyover river and flyover country? Well, I was going to graduate school in flyover country, and I say that, I use that term advisedly, I guess. As someone who's come to love Nebraska very much, it offends me a little bit. But it's still the way a lot of people think about it. And the horrors of driving across Interstate 80 to get to Colorado. But when John and I were conceptualizing that project, he told me he thought it would be a good idea to pick a river that was entirely within one state so that I wouldn't have to deal with conflicting jurisdictions and water laws and things like that. So, and I think that was a good idea. And as I've thought about it since, and talked to other people about projects they've done with rivers, or when they've talked about trying to do research on a river, and they say, oh, I want to do a big river, an important river, like the Columbia or the Mississippi or the Missouri or the Colorado, all of which are super important. But for somebody starting out, there's an awful lot to bite off in those cases because they're so big, they cross so many jurisdictions, and there's so much going on with them. And I like to think that the Elkhorn is a nice beginner river. And as a beginner historian and beginner environmental historian, I think it really helped me wrap my mind around writing a history of a place and a river. And then when it came, and I put this book down, or this project, for probably 20 years. It was my master's thesis, and I got an article or two out of it in journals, but I thought that was as far as it would go. And I got some interest in it. I can't remember how they got wind of it, but the folks at Texas Tech, who have this Plains History Series, approached me and said, do you think there's a book in that Elkhorn project? And I said, gosh, I guess so. And look back on it. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, yeah, I could turn that into a book. And I'd like to talk at some point about going back to this project after it had been a cold case for basically 20 years. But then again, it was not just a good beginner river, but for the purpose of the Plains History Series, it was perfect in that it begins and ends in the Plains. So it's really contained and really focused in terms of what that book series wants to do in terms of its subject matter. I'm afraid I'm losing my train of thought there.
Well, you mentioned that you'd like to talk about what it was like to go back to a book after, or to go back to a piece after so long. And yeah, going, you know, writing something as an MA student, as a master's student, and then returning to it when you're a professor, that's a pretty big change. And what was that like? I'm interested in hearing that.
Well, it turned out to be really rewarding. And the other thing I was thinking about came back to mind. Why write about this river that's a minor river? And it's not navigable, and it's not considered important by a lot of people. As I think about it, it's kind of like, why would you write history about somebody other than George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or, you know, powerful dead white men? There's a lot of history out there that can tell you a lot about life and a lot about the human condition. It's, you know, social history or, you know, bottom-up history, to look at it those ways. And I think the Elkhorn's a type of river that is sort of in that category, even though it's not, you know, one of the big glamour rivers like the Mississippi or the Columbia. I think you can get an awful lot out of doing a smaller history of a detailed history of a smaller river.
I really like that formulation, thinking about it in the same way that we think about studying people. As someone who also studies a bit of a minor waterway, I might steal that. That's pretty good, actually.
Good. And then going back to the point about coming back to a project after it had been cold for 20 years easily. It was really gratifying when I resurrected this to find new sources and to go back and work on some writing. And there's a pretty significant overhaul, as you might guess, on something that was 20 years old and written when I was just starting graduate school. And some of it was, I read some of that stuff and said, oh, that's pretty good. And golly, maybe I was smarter than I thought I was then. But there was an awful lot of it that I read and just cringed. And it was wonderful to have a chance to go back and fix that and to see how much I had grown as a writer and as a researcher and historian. And as I dug up sources that I hadn't considered and reconceptualized the thing, the master's thesis was really focused just on flooding. And this book, in its current incarnation, does a lot more. The subtitle is Living, Dying, and the Nature of Disaster in the Elkhorn River Basin. So rather than just focus on flood history in the basin, I expanded it to try to get at how did people live with the river? How did the river shape life for the people who were in the Elkhorn Basin? How did the people who lived in the Elkhorn Basin shape the river? And then as the notion of natural disaster came into it, and this was something I hadn't really been aware of when I wrote the master's thesis, because some of the works on that hadn't been put out yet, like Ted Steinberg's Acts of God, for example, allowed me to reconceptualize this and not only get at flooding, but how did people live with the river? How does the river, to the extent that you can identify with a river, live with people? And then how has the conceptualization of disaster changed over time? So it was fun in a lot of ways to go back and redo the project. It's a whole lot better than it was in its first incarnation. And it was kind of interesting to have that experience as I work with graduate students, especially to talk to them about the importance of revision and the growth process as a historian and how important it is to take, say, a dissertation through different phases. Like, look, while you're in school, you just got to get this thing done so you can get your degree. Then you go back and work on it and revise it and turn it into a book. And there's a whole different process that happens at that stage. And I really got to relive that in a dramatic way by taking something that I started in the early 1990s and come back to it in the 2010s and see what I could do with it and how my historian's muscles, I guess, had grown, or my historian's brain and skills had grown over those 20 plus years. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the book a little bit then. And let's just start by setting the scene. I mean, this is an environmental history, so let's talk about the environment. Where is the Elkhorn River? You mentioned a little while ago that it is purely a prairie river, that it's entirely contained on the plains. But where exactly does it flow from and to? And what kind of environment is created by the Elkhorn?
The Elkhorn starts about in the middle of Nebraska, but in northern Nebraska, and it's entirely contained within the state. And I don't know that I could give any landmarks there that a lot of people would be familiar with. It's a lot easier to understand that it empties into the Platte River just outside of Omaha. So it starts north-central Nebraska and flows sort of east southeast towards Omaha, so it runs sort of diagonally from north central Nebraska down towards east central Nebraska, where Omaha is. And the more I got into the river, the more I found out that even though it's contained within a state and contained within the Great Plains, the environment that it flows through changes significantly, and the river itself has different characteristics and really a different personality depending on where you encounter it. There's an upper basin, which is where the headwaters are, and it's flowing through a region called the Sand Hills in Nebraska, and it's more of a stream, I guess, than a river. And there, in the banks of it are very broad, and there aren't any steep banks typically. So imagine a big flat place like the plains. There is enough of a depression so that you get this stream flowing through it. And it's, I would say, a little gentler up there and smaller. And as it flows down towards Omaha and picks up more water from tributaries, and it goes out of the sandhills and into a sandy loam type soil. It's got a little bit steeper banks, and it picks up speed, and it picks up, and it gets bigger and broader and wider, which is typical for rivers. So that's where it is and roughly what it's like. It's all within the plains region. In the western or the upper part of the basin, there's a lot of cattle ranching that goes on now, so grasslands. Originally, the lower basin was also grassland, but that has a lot of it been turned into farming, especially corn, soybeans, and some other crops. So they're really massive farms in the lower basin. And there's also some, while there's ranching in the upper basin, you come into the lower basin, there are some places where there are feedlots. So there's sort of mixed agricultural use. And there are, I can't give you the number, but there are a number of small towns and even a fairly major city in the basin. And a lot of those are located right on the banks of the river. And that's something I'm going to drop and plant the seed. We'll come back to talk about that in a little bit. The biggest city in the basin is the city of Norfolk, Nebraska, which is northeast corner of the state. And I think the population there is around 20,000. It's one of the bigger cities in Nebraska. But a big city in Nebraska, I guess, is relative. One of the trivia facts they gave me when I moved there to go to grad school was that on football Saturdays, the stadium would qualify as, I think, the third largest city in the state after Omaha and Lincoln. So that's what the environment's like and where the river flows.
I'll admit, and I like to think that I have at least a passing grasp of geography, but I had never heard of Norfolk, Nebraska before reading this book. And then I read a whole lot about Norfolk, Nebraska.
Sure. And if you ever get through there, or anybody else listening to this and are interested, there's a real nice road that runs basically along the river basin, along the river from Omaha up to Chadron, Nebraska. That's just delightful. And it goes through Norfolk, and there's a terrific museum in Norfolk. You should stop at the Elkhorn Valley Museum, which is where I got some of the research for the book.
Why does the Elkhorn flood so regularly? And indeed, does it flood particularly regularly compared to other rivers?
I don't know. I didn't do a comparative analysis of how often or even how regularly it floods. It does flood. And the way I came to think about flooding as an act of a river is that it's something that, as far as I know, all rivers do, maybe not all of them, but where the river lives, where its bed is, you can count on it being there, I guess, most of the time. But then there's the next stage as you go uphill from the core, the center of the channel, where you've got floodplain. And that is, at least as I came to think of it, a place where the river, it's not there all the time, but it can almost be expected to be there from time to time, depending on rainfall and other things that happen in the basin. So I didn't find a pattern. It's not like the Elkhorn floods every year or every 5 years reliably, but it does flood. And one of the things that was a challenge with this book was, one, I tried to locate where the floods were because it grew out of a flood history in my master's thesis. And it was pretty regularly. Somebody who grew up in the basin, if you were born in the basin and spent your life there for, say, 75 or 80 years or more, you'd probably have three or four major floods and I don't know how many minor floods. So it's not anything you can count on with any regularity, but you can count on it happening, and you can expect to have it happen more than once or multiple times in your lifetime. And in Nebraska, and for this river in particular, it's, I think, got a lot to do with the topography, the fact that the river basin is broad and shallow, and there are some pretty severe weather events that happen in the central continent weather pattern, climate pattern. And there are two different ways usually that the Elkhorn floods. One is in the wintertime and a function of, say, the ground being frozen in the basin and ice clogging part of the river channel. And in the spring, if they get a particularly warm spell and a lot of the snow and ice that's on the ground melts, it will overwhelm the carrying capacity of the channel. And that gets complicated frequently by ice in the river. Even if the river's moving and there's some ice in it, it'll build up at bridges or bends in the river, and the ice will create a dam and then force water up out of the channel and into the surrounding territory. And then the other one is, and that usually happens maybe March, April, when things are melting. And the other most frequent time of flooding is maybe May and June, maybe some into July, where you get summer thunderstorms. And if there's been a particularly rainy period in the basin, and the soils are saturated and you get a big thunderstorm, there's no place for that water to go other than it can't seep into the soil, and it will, you know, really flow quickly into the river, and then the river will exceed the capacity of the channel to contain it, and that's when you get the river coming up out of its channel and into the floodplain. So in a nutshell, that's an explanation of how and why it floods, and I can't help you. The regularity question is kind of tough, but it does flood fairly often, by my reckoning, and occasionally pretty dramatically.
And people have been putting up with floods in the Elkhorn for a very long time, because people have been living by the Elkhorn for a very long time. So what is the long human history of this river? Who lived on it before American conquest, and how did they make their lives along its banks, or further inland for that matter?
Gosh, it wasn't the heart of a homeland for any of the historic tribes that I've located. The Pawnee Indians lived in part of the basin some of the time. The Omahas, some of the Dakota and Lakota tribes passed through it. But people have been in the basin, or at least there's archaeological record of human inhabitants. I think the number was 10, 12,000 years going back. And typically, thinking about this up until Americans and Europeans started coming into the valley and settling it, for the most part, it seems like the indigenous people who lived in and around the river mostly stayed up away from it. It was rare that they would put a village within reach of flooding. And most of those peoples, or at least in the time that I looked at, were either nomadic or semi-nomadic. Some of them had year-round villages where they lived, but those generally were up out of the floodplain, and I didn't find much evidence that they were impacted by flooding. sorry about that. Repeat the question, if you would. Who lived there for how long?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I was just kind of generally curious, because one of the things you emphasize at the beginning of the book is that, you know, people have lived along this river for a long time. And I was just curious, who had lived on it before American conquest? How did they make their lives along the river or along its banks? Or as you say in the book, maybe further inland, what has the role been historically prior to American conquest of the river in the lives of people who lived around it?
Right. Thank you for getting me back on track. I need another cup of coffee.
That's okay. There's a lot. It's not a particularly long book, but you cover a great deal in this book. So I totally understand.
So one of the things, and let me get back into that that line of thinking. One of the things that I found in going back to the project was some sources that I hadn't spotted the first time around related to either pre-contact or very early contact records of American Indians living in and around the Elkhorn. And that was even though some of the tribes, many of the tribes were nomadic and semi-nomadic, occasionally they would have pitched a camp within reach of the river. And in some of the winter counts I found, and some listeners might not know what a winter count is, but a winter count is a type of a calendar kept by some plains tribes, and typically it was done on a bison hide, and it had a pictograph for each year, and it would typically start in the center of this bison hide and then work in a spiral pattern moving from the center out to the edges of the thing. And every year, whoever was keeping this winter count or calendar or history would choose a particular event to commemorate, and that would serve as a symbol for that year and a memory device for telling the oral history of the people. And I located some winter counts from people who lived in that area, and there were a few years where they noted, say that a flood had happened and flooded out 4 teepees of a particular band, or that a number of people had drowned in a flood for some reason. So there was a sense of, I guess, flooding disaster that predates Anglo settlement of the basin. And another thing that I had not thought about, partly because in the first incarnation of the work I was interested mostly in flooding, was that there were some benefits. And this is probably should be obvious if you stop and think about it. It's like, what good is the river to folks who live along it? I imagine for a source of drinking water and cooking. But one of the surprises I found in the winter counts was reference to bison apparently trying to cross the river when it was frozen and falling through and getting stuck in the river, and in some cases frozen in. And some of the Indian peoples who lived near the river could use that sort of like a deep freeze. And they found where these bison had fallen through, and when they got hungry, they could go out and they would cut some of these frozen bison out of the river and haul them up and cook them. So it was sort of this windfall out of the frozen river. So that's a way where I was getting in the second incarnation of the book away from just flooding and disasters to how did people live with the river? How did it help them? What things did they do to the river? And this goes back into, I think, late 1600s, maybe the 1700s, where those episodes were recorded. So it really turned out to be a lot more interesting story and more involved story than I thought the first time around.
Yeah. And of course, in the 19th century, Americans do conquer the Great Plains. And after this point, how did, in your words in the book, how did newcomers reimagine the Elkhorn? When did Americans begin settling towns along the river? And how did the lives of the people who lived there, and how did the river itself change as a result?
That's a big question. I'm going to try to keep that all straight in my
It is a big question.
Mind.
If I can remind you if necessary. I think my questions are maybe a little unwieldy today.
That's okay. And if I get sidetracked, I'll ask for help. One of the big shifts came with overland traffic and the development of Nebraska, and some of the earliest white or American settlements in the basin started in the 1850s, 1860s. And in this respect, I think the Elkhorn was similar in a lot of ways to, say, the Platte River Basin and the Platte Valley. The Platte turned into one of the major highways across the country. It's still one of the major highways across the country. It was basically the route for a big chunk of the Oregon Trail. And that's partly river topography, partly plains topography, but it was a real handy way for wagons to travel west along the banks of the Platte. And not too long after the Oregon Trail, the Elkhorn served a similar purpose for settlers who were moving up into that part of Nebraska. So they would be coming out of Omaha travel a couple miles west to where the Elkhorn was, and then they could follow sort of a natural highway up the Elkhorn River basin, right alongside the river, up to northeastern Nebraska, north central Nebraska. And I'm going to get a little bit ahead of the settlement story here. It was not just a highway for these overland settlers, but as they moved up the basin and founded towns, that also, a couple decades later, was where railroads expanded, and like they did, like the Union Pacific did across the Platte Valley, some railroads went up the Elkhorn Basin and connected northeastern, north central, and then northwestern Nebraska to the hubs in Omaha and other places. And then a couple decades after that, that's where some of the paved roads followed. I think the road I want is US 275, which I had the pleasure of bicycling years ago. And that too follows along the river and along the railroad tracks. So there's been this transportation corridor that followed along the river base, the banks, much like happened in the Platte. So there I got a little bit ahead of what I think your question was. It's like, how did things change once, I'm going to use short-term, white people showed up and started settling the basin? So what they did, first of all, was follow that natural highway up from the Omaha area into northeast and then north central Nebraska. And as they went and they were looking for town sites, part of what they were interested in was water power for milling. Because once farmers were in and growing things, they needed to be able to process their crops, and they were looking for grist mills. One of the earliest things set up at a lot of these town sites were sawmills, and at the time, the best option for power was water power, and it was a bit of a challenge harnessing the Elkhorn and its tributaries, because unlike, say, the rivers I knew in Ohio that had mills, or where I've seen them in New England, it didn't quite have the topography and the depth, and there were very few falls that could be harnessed to power a water wheel. But there were certain sites that were better than others, and in those places the river or its tributaries could be dammed, and you could set up basically a mill pond and get a little bit of a fall of water. And that's where they would put a sawmill and maybe a grist mill, and then those mill locations frequently were the nucleus for settlements, because a lot of business had to be done there. So you had places like West Point, which is a small city along the Elkhorn, or village. Norfolk started as a mill town, and there were a number of others as well. So that is part of what I had in mind where I talked about people coming into the basin and reimagining it. It wasn't just a highway. It started off as a highway, and it wasn't just a place where you might camp alongside of it for part of the year or all of the year and hope to cut some frozen bison out of it for a food supply. It became a place of permanent year-round settlement where the people depended on the water power to be the engine of their economy and the engine of their settlement. And as they were doing that, my reference to building mill dams and mill ponds, it's like they started engineering the river to an extent that had not been done by anybody up until that point. And that also had the unintended consequence, I guess, of concentrating capital and building and assets along the riverbanks, because they had to be close to them for the water power. But that also put them in jeopardy of being damaged by floods, and it was sort of a regular occurrence from that point on. So I think I want to take a deep breath there. This has started getting us into the point of reimagining the Elkhorn, but I don't want to go too far down a route without making sure I cover some ground you're interested in.
Well, that's perfect, because that's actually my next question, because as much as the Elkhorn itself gets reimagined after American conquest and American settlement, as you kind of indicated, the nature of flooding changes too, and the meanings that people ascribe to flooding also changes. So why is that the case? Why do floods become more destructive, and how do American settlers respond to flooding on the Elkhorn as you very, very well put it, as capital becomes concentrated along this river?
Gosh, how'd they respond? They dealt with it, for one thing, and it's kind of, there's a counterexample that I didn't mention very much in the book, maybe just in passing. The town of Niobrara, Nebraska, was located on a tributary of the Niobrara River, and it flooded and flooded, and eventually the town people decided they'd had enough, and they moved the town to higher ground. I didn't find many cases of that happening in the Elkhorn Basin, so people either thought it was worth dealing with or it was too much trouble to move away from the river. But most of the original town sites that I'm familiar with pretty much stayed where they were. And because they'd put homes and buildings and farms in harm's way, essentially, started responding to it sort of on the first phase, I think I label in the book as a defensive phase, where they would put up dikes or levees along the riverbanks and hope to contain the river and keep it away from their buildings. And that went on into the 20th century. Eventually, they took some more offensive measures to try to change the river. And some of these start on a small scale in the late 1800s, but they certainly get more aggressive in the 20th century. And what I mean by more offensive things, and this is rather than trying to contain the river or keep it away from buildings, try to change the river itself. For example, dredging the channel to make it deeper so that it could hold more water, or straightening the river channel so that it doesn't have so many bends and the water can move more quickly downstream. So in some ways, those efforts helped protect property and helped reduce flooding. But in other ways, I think even those had some unintended consequences in that the faster moving water in the straightened channels would sometimes do more damage during floods than if it had been allowed to meander or spread out as it would naturally. And then I think in a lot of ways, the climax of the offensive phase of trying to deal with floodings came maybe in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And part of what happened, I'm forgetting part of the story as I go along here. So a lot of this was done sort of on an ad hoc piecemeal basis by towns. And so the city of Norfolk would deal with the Elkhorn in its jurisdiction. And then they would sort of shape the river so that the water would go past there and downstream, but then the next town down would have to deal with it. And they might put up levees and so on. So it was done piecemeal on a local basis. By the 1940s, there were some particularly bad floods. And that is when the Army Corps of Engineers got involved and came in and did a study on the river. And they made some recommendations about some particularly aggressive changes to the channel and to the basin, a lot of which didn't get done because they would have been very expensive to do. And from the Corps of Engineers' point of view, the ideal situation would be to treat the entire length of the river so that there wouldn't be these piecemeal modifications to it, and you could really do a systematic full basin treatment to mitigate flooding. But it was cost prohibitive in terms of doing that. So I've kind of run through, I think, most of what your question was, but I want to stop and see if I missed something or if you'd like to redirect.
Well, I'm just curious about the floods of the 1940s, because you spend a fair amount of time on that era of flooding in the book. And in particular, you know, if for no other reason, you should acquire a copy of the book, listeners, because there's some amazing photographs in there of the floods from the 1940s. But I'm wondering about those floods in particular. Why were those years particularly destructive as far as flooding goes? Was it just sort of a roll of the dice? Those just happened to be bad years for flooding? And what was the result of all that destruction? How did cities and towns respond? And you touched on that a little bit, but I was just hoping to zoom in a bit more on that decade.
Sure. I think a couple things were going on that led to that series of floods, and it was 40 and 44 at that point was the worst flood in the history of the basin. For one, the population of the basin had grown steadily. So from the settlement period in the 1850s, 1860s, through the 1940s, the population had grown steadily. A lot of the settlements had probably hit their peak, if not around 1940, just before then. So there was a lot more of value in the basin. And say compared to the first small towns where there might be a few buildings, now there were more people, more buildings, more assets in harm's way. So it's kind of a matter of having more chips on the table, I guess, to think in terms of poker. There was more stuff that could be harmed. And then in the 19, and also the river had changed. I mentioned a minute ago how it had been channelized and levees put into some places. So the river itself had been changed. And then in 40 and 44, there were some particularly bad storms. The rainfall was high, and they were particularly wet years. So it was kind of a, what's the word I want? The perfect storm, in a way, of more things of value having been placed in the basin, and then some particularly wet and stormy years with particularly bad floods. And so the flood damages were astronomical in those years. And the people in the basin started petitioning more to get help from outside sources, if not from the state, from the federal government. So that's part of how the Corps got involved. And also during these years, I think it was in the 30s, the Corps' mission got changed. Originally, the Corps was aimed at working on navigable rivers. And as more people were calling for help with floods, the mandate of the Corps changed so that they would get more involved in flood control rather than just working on navigation. So that's part of what changed their jurisdiction to be able to come in. Plus, there were calls for help from people in the basin and I think from politicians in the area. So you get that particularly tragic set of floods in 40 and 44. And then the Corps came in and did a massive study on it. And that was one of the richest resources I found for putting the book together, was that they had hearings up and down the basin asking people, what kind of damage have you had? What would you recommend? What's your experience been like flooding here? And they recorded all this stuff. So it was this real terrific treasure trove of documents that the Corps put together. And then as an arm of the federal government, they had the potential with that kind of money and technology behind them to come in and do some massive changes to the river. As I mentioned a minute ago, as they did the studies on this, the cost, and I don't remember the numbers, but it would have been prohibitive to do this to the basin. It would make more sense, and part of the reason the Corps chose the projects that it did, and say, for example, would do massive projects on the Missouri, was the cost-benefit analysis made that attractive or worth doing. And as they ran the numbers on what to do in the Elkhorn Basin, there just weren't enough people and assets there to justify the output of doing the projects that they did.
I am anxiously awaiting the day when some enterprising environmental historian writes the definitive history of the Army Corps of Engineers, because your book, among the other really interesting things that it does, it really drives home how important the Army Corps is in making these kinds of decisions about what, you know, the modern American environment will look like, and the relationship between humanity and the environment in the United States is so much shaped, especially in the mid-20th century, by the Corps of Engineers. Your book does a really good job of underscoring that fact, I think, and I'd like a larger study on that.
Thank you. And it would be nice to do. There's a great project for you, Steve.
I got enough on my plate with one book, let alone a second project yet.
Right.
So let's move ahead a bit in time and tell us what the river's flood history has looked like more recently. Since the mid-20th century, have people's relationships to the Elkhorn changed much? Have there been more floods, more devastating floods? How have things looked like over the course of the latter half of the 20th century moving into the 21st century?
Well, bottom line is the river keeps flooding. It hasn't stopped. I think the last flood I deal with at any length is 2010, And there was a particularly bad one that year. Some people claimed it was as bad as or worse than the flood of 1944, but it's kind of hard to compare because things change so much and trying to figure out what's the benchmark. Is it the dollar amount of damages? Is it how high the floodwaters registered on the different things that are used to measure that? For one, it's continued to happen, and so it continues to be a fact of life. I think one of the things I found, I guess, most heartening about what has been going on recently is that there's been a realization both in places in the Elkhorn Basin, and I've seen that in other places around the country, and it's happening around here where I live in Texas, that there are certain flood-prone areas where local governments have essentially given up on trying to rebuild, and they're telling people, you know, no, we're going to buy you out. You just need to move out of here. And that's starting to happen, especially around Norfolk, where some properties are in the flood zone are being abandoned because it just doesn't make sense to keep rebuilding in a place that is going to get hit again and again by flooding. And around here, my in-laws live near a creek, and in their subdivision, there were 5 houses in the lowest part of the subdivision that flooded and flooded and flooded, and finally the city bought them out, and they just tore the houses down and turned it into green space, and that's part of what's being done in other places, including in places on the Elkhorn.
So if there's one takeaway that you hope people come away from this book understanding, what might that be? In your conclusion, you talk about what the history of the Elkhorn tells us about human relationships to rivers and the environment kind of more generally. And I'm wondering if that's sort of the takeaway, or if there's a larger point that you hope readers come away understanding from your book.
Wow, good question.
It's a question that usually people express frustration at because it's not an easy question. I understand.
Yeah. I think for me, and what I really wanted to get to by the end of it, in some ways, one of the frustrating things about doing this project was, and this is sort of like playing Monday morning quarterback, if you're a football fan, an NFL fan, on Monday morning and say, boy, you know, Patrick Mahomes should have done this yesterday. But looking at all these floods in a compressed way, I've been working on this for, I don't know, 20 some odd years, but I've got 150 plus years of Elkhorn history compressed into that time. And to go through the historical record and if you're looking for floods and say, okay, there's a flood and they did this, there's a flood and they did this, there's a flood and they did this 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, you almost want to bang yourself on the head and say, hey, look what's going on. Why are you doing this? Why do you keep letting this happen? And I think it's partly because in the moment, you don't necessarily realize it. And even though the newspapers in the basin that reported on that would frequently refer to other floods, if you get 10 years, 20 years between major floods, I think people in a way kind of forget about it. But then for me, where I'm sitting here reading maybe in 1 week about the flood of 1940, and a week later the flood of 1944, and then the next week I move along and I'm doing 1978 or 1993 or 2010, and you kind of see this pattern. It's like the same, and I refer to this at one point that in the book, that's in a way it just seems like it's one damn flood after another. But that is, I guess, the benefit or the curse of a historian, where you can see this long duration of things in very close proximity that is not evident, I don't think, to somebody up front living through it at the moment. So it's a windy way of getting to a response to your question. I think what I'd like to see for people, whether they're in the Elkhorn Basin or the Platte Basin or Columbia, Missouri, Mississippi, whatever, that rivers kind of have a life of their own, that one of the things that rivers will do is expand. They will use their floodplain from time to time. to live with them, I think you need to expect that. And I think I, you know, in my perfect world, if I could have people who live with rivers do something, it would maybe be back off and give them the space to do what they do rather than try to impose a will on them and force them into things that they don't want to do or can't really be reasonably expected not to do. So maybe take a deep breath, back off, and get out of the floodplain. But that's easy for a guy sitting in a history office in Fort Worth, Texas to say. And it's a different matter for people who've got lives and generations of lives and lots of money invested in projects where they are. But there's my two cents. The rivers are going to do what they do, and it's kind of it might be a good idea to back away from them and let them do that.
And then finally, this book has been out for a couple years now, came out in 2018. What have you been working on in the interim? Do you have another project that is coming down the river, so to speak?
I
couldn't
so.
Help myself.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
No, I appreciate that. I'm taking some of the lessons and themes that I picked up doing this book, and I'm currently working on an environmental history of Fort Worth and North Texas. I haven't quite figured out the parameters yet. It might be just the county where Fort Worth is. For people who don't live here and might not be familiar with it, there's Fort Worth. We're not far from Dallas. And really, over the years, they've sort of grown in, grown into this giant metropolitan area that we around here call the Metroplex or the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. I think probably at some point I need to deal with that entire entity. But I'm starting off with the environmental history of Fort Worth focused on water. Part of that is going to deal with the Trinity River, which flows past Fort Worth. And in a lot of ways, the Trinity is similar to the Elkhorn in that it is a minor river. It's not navigable. It does flood. There was a horrific flood here in 1949 that led the Corps to come in and put in a massive levee system and to really manipulate the river so that it has protected Fort Worth. And that has been pretty successful over the years. And there's a terrific hike bike path along the top of the levee. And I was just out on it earlier today exercising. So I'm going to try to get at the history of Fort Worth from the perspective of water, whether it's the city's relationship with the river or, I shouldn't say or, it's going to be and, how has the city developed its own water supply and what has the history of water usage and water pollution told us about Fort Worth? And one of the places, I don't want to go too far off this because I haven't really developed it yet, and I know you're not asking me a lot about this other project, but one of our main tourist attractions here is the Stockyards area, where there used to be two giant meat processing plants operated by Armour and Swift. And when those things opened, it was a wonderful day. Many people in the city celebrated it because it meant economic development and jobs, and Fort Worth was growing and becoming more important. But almost immediately, they had an impact on the river system here because a lot of the animal waste from the living animals and waste from or byproduct from the slaughtering and packaging of the animals ended up in the water supply. And there are some just horrific stories about what happened downstream from where the packing plants were. So that's going to be part of that upcoming story. And it's going to be, the meat-pocalypse of the Trinity River, among other things.
Yeah, that's an article title right there if I've ever heard one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like an amazing project. I'm really excited to read that somewhere, hopefully in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah. Don't hold your breath. I feel like I'm working in slow motion, but yeah, someday.
Yeah. Well, when it's done, we'll have you back on the show.
I'd love it.
Todd Kerstetter is a professor of history at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas. His latest book is Flood on the Tracks, Living, Dying, and the Nature of Disaster in the Elkhorn River Basin, which came out in 2018 with Texas Tech University Press. Thank you so much for coming on the show today to talk with me, Todd.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.